KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. You're listening to Radio Orbit. My name is Mike Hagan. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
I'll be alone and you wait. Sun shines on your back, I'll sit, I wait. The rain's coming, but won't you take me on that sweet headless wind?
KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. You got it. It's Mike Hagan, Radio Orbit, about 5, 6, 7 minutes after 11 p.m. Now on the 19th of February, 2007. All right, big thank you to Debbie Johnson, of course, Free Range Radio Theater. Great stuff as always. Kelvin and Jason doing it up before that. Jazz plus blues equals spring in the air. Tech Radio. Love the show as always. Jeff Wheeler starting things off with Uncommon Light, 3 to 5 p.m. every Monday, Radio Excelente on KOPN, your imagination station. Glad to be here with you and glad to be a part of it all. As always, okay, thanks to everybody who participated and listened in the show last week. Thanks to Paul Laffley. Holy shaving cream. Is it me or was that just a remarkable person? Paul Laffley, just amazing. From his work on the World Trade Towers in the early 60s. By the way, that was outrageous, sort of a sublime and revealing segment that I urge anyone to listen to, whether you're a fan of the arts or not. You know, Paul and I had no intention of talking politics or 9/11 or any of that stuff. We were just talking about his background. And when he told the story of how he was involved on the design team for the World Trade Centers in the early 1960s and how, you know, his impression of what happened when they came down. And trust me, that's an impression that is worth listening to because it's a guy that was on the team that designed them to begin with. And anyway, Paul Laffley, thanks so much. And we'll get him back on the program for sure. He's a visual artist of great renown, but has a depth of knowledge that's just outrageous. So he's great, and I can't wait to have Paul back on the air. All right, thanks, Paul, and we'll do it again, all right? We also heard the music of the Bastard Fairies, one of my favorite new bands that I sort of discovered in the last month or so, sort of controversial, only because there was some discussion during the show about the music and whether or not they were, you know, whether it was being dug or not, but I should dig it, and I'm sort of glad that, you know, people are talking about whether they like it or not. If you're not talking about it, then it's just sort of, you know, not even making you think. So anyway, either you love it or hate it, I think that's good. So check it all out on the web. If you missed the show, it's at the website, www.mikehagan.com. In the program archives, go check it out for yourselves. Share it with your friends. Let me know. All right, tonight, an interview I recorded about a month ago with Judith Ann Brown. Judith Ann Brown, the daughter of John Marco Allegro. In fact, the program tonight dedicated to the great John Marco Allegro. John Allegro, for those of you uninitiated, the author of many books, among them a barn burner from 1970 called The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. And John Allegro actually was born and died on February 17th, just a couple days ago, not the same year, of course, but he was born on the 17th in 1923, died on the same day in 1988. And so we'll do the show tonight in honor of this wonderful and courageous guy, John Marco Allegro. If you didn't notice, we've got some live music for you as well. And we'll be doing that for a bit here for the next 45 minutes or so in the studio with me, John Henry. And let's see, where's that microphone? Do I have it on, John? Is that it?
Hello?
Yeah, hey.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. John Henry and the band, singer-songwriter, local guitar player, has a band here in town, does his own thing as well. But anyway, thanks, John, for getting things started here. What was that that we heard there, John?
That was a song called Sweetness Wind.
Sweetness Wind.
Sweetness Wind.
When did you write it?
I wrote it over the summertime.
When summer? Last summer?
No, summer of, I guess, what year? 07 now, right? It was 06.
Yeah.
It was like in August of 06.
All right, it's a great song. First time I've heard you play that. The first time I've actually heard you play without the band.
Yeah. Is it good? Is it all right?
I like it. I like the band, and I like to hear you without the band, too. I think you're a good songwriter. Anyway, thanks for coming down.
Yeah,
and
thank you for having us.
Yeah, we've got a whole sort of studio full of people here, and I don't know who's here. You got some of the band members here as well and some
see, the thing is we got
friends.
We got an entourage.
The entourage. The John Henry gang, as
no,
it were.
No, we just have a few friends that were hanging out over the Blue Fugue.
Yeah.
And we just kind of came over because we know you're such a nice guy. And let us hang out and play songs.
That's right. Well, I think, before we do that, let's play another song in a minute. But the reason you're here, we got a show that's coming up on Friday, the 23rd,
yeah, Friday,
I think.
Isn't it?
Hold on. Let me get your friend on the microphone here. What is that? Mike? I can't even see. Mike 4? I'll just turn them all on. That's what I do.
They're all on.
How's that one? You on there?
Check.
Who's this there?
This is Rob.
Rob,
the piano.
All right. Rob plays a piano in the same band. That's John Henry, and it's called John Henry and the Engine, by the way.
John Henry and the Engine?
Is the name of the band.
That is, yep.
And, all right, so tell us what's happening this weekend.
This weekend, we're playing a show with two really great bands called The Feed and Hazard to Your Booty, and us, John Henry and the Engine. The Feed, you know, they're...
I know The Feed, I know Dave, and I know the band, and I like their music.
Yeah,
I played
Hazard
some of their stuff
Booty's
a week
like
or two ago.
Funk band, they're great, and then we're doing it... I think it's going to be a really fun night.
That's this coming Friday, 23rd?
This coming Friday at the Blue Fugue. And later on in the night, we have some tickets to give away to the show.
Yeah, what are you going to give? We got one pair, two pair, how many?
Three pair.
All right, we'll give away three pair of tickets for the show a little bit later. Maybe we'll give away a pair in just a little while here, and then I'll save a couple. We'll do one pair every hour. I go on until 2, so we'll do a pair the first hour,
that's
second hour, third hour.
It's symmetrical. It's perfect.
Yes, you know. All right. So... at the Blue Few, yeah. We got you guys, The Feed, and who else?
Hazard to Your Booty.
That's right. That's the guys with the big hair and that whole gang, right?
They've been, they were huge here a few years back, huge. I mean, being like, you know, they could bring out a really big crowd. And, now they're kind of rejoined. We play with them at the Blue Note in October. And they're like the nicest people. And if you like dancing and you like rock and roll music, there's no place you want to be on Friday night besides the Blue Fugue. It's going to be a good time.
All right, cool. Then what about, tell me a little bit about the band since they're all here, or at least some of them are here.
They're great.
Yeah, we are.
No, we just got, we were just signed to Hometone Records.
Hometone Records, that's right. I got an email from you last week or two ago.
Yeah. Big shout out to Wes, if you're out in Radio Land. Thank you.
Right on. I hope you listen, Wes. By the way, we're streaming live on the web if you're not in the local area. I hope you told your friends or whatever, but KOPN.org, just click the Listen Live button, and also every Monday via Cosmic Waves Radio, they stream my show. So anyway, lots of ways to hear the program over the web and over the traditional airwaves, but tell us a little bit about the deal you did with Hometone.
The deal with Hometone is they were fans of our music, and they wanted to work with us and help us make records and tour.
Where are they based out of? Columbia.
Uh-huh. It just seemed like a really cool, creative, and good business move as well. So, good relationship so far. We're happy to see how everything goes with it.
Plans to make an album?
Yeah, we're going to record a record. We have a record out now. I guess that would be an EP, right?
Yeah, it's an EP.
It's sort of a record. It's just like a collection.
What's it called?
Songs.
Charlie Baby.
It's called Charlie Baby.
Right. I have a copy of it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what happened with Charlie Baby? What are we doing with it?
Everyone's sort of looking at each other saying, what do you mean? What? Huh?
Yeah, we licensed it to MTV recently.
Ah, that's right. That's another thing. So what, are they playing that on some background tracks
or
something?
Yeah.
For what?
For
Pimp My Ride.
Pimp My Ride.
Yeah.
And what else? Like maybe like Laguna Beach. What's that other show? Like Maui Fever, Real World.
Wow. Have you heard it on any of the shows?
No, it's not on until
summer, right?
Coming in the spring and fall.
Right, I'm sure.
Spring, summer, and fall.
So they're producing all that stuff. Wow, that'll be cool when you hear that for the first time on a show like that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a thrill. So.
Yeah.
Right on. All right, well, good things happening for you guys. I'm proud of you, John. That's great.
Thank you.
Let's hear a little bit more of what it's about here. I want you to play another song for us, okay?
Okay, which song?
I don't know.
All right.
I guess that's your choice. This
our
is John...
choice.
John Henry, by the way, of John Henry and the Engine, and they'll be playing on Friday night, the 23rd of February, just a couple of days from now, down at the Blue Fugue, down on 9th Street, and you can get a little taste of what you'll hear, plus bass, drums, and keyboards right now. This is John. What are you going to play for us, John?
I'm going to play Terrible Beauty right now.
Terrible Beauty.
Terrible Beauty. And it's kind of weird playing without... the band, it's can't wait till Friday till we get to really crank it out there and do it. But
Here it is, everybody. John Henry from John Henry and the Engine, Terrible Beauty. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Thank you.
John Henry, Terrible Beauty. Good stuff, John.
Thank you.
And that's when you're going to play with the band on Friday?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Maybe with a horn section.
Right? Ah. And what's, now, what's the typical band makeup?
The typical band makeup is A.J. Gennaro on the drums, Rob Martin on the keys and good looks, and then Steve Sanger on the bass.
Yeah.
You are.
So you told me.
I'm sorry.
Is it a stand-up bass? He hides behind it or something?
Yeah.
All right. Look, give me a second here, and I will get back to my business here for a second. And if I can find what the heck I was talking about, I'll do it here. All right. Hello to everybody listening over the web, and whether it's over the traditional airwaves or streaming, you know, live or otherwise. Every Monday we broadcast a show from the perfectly adequate studios of KOPN in beautifully downtown Columbia, Missouri. We stream the show live as well on the web at kopn.org, kopn.org. Just click on the Listen Live button, and you can hear the stream. It's actually a 64K stream on the KOPN site. And then if you have sort of a slower connection, a dial-up or something like that, you can go over to cosmicwavesradio.com, and you can hear a 24K stream from there. All right, so anyway, thanks to everyone who makes it happen live on the radio and on the net. Thanks also to Larry, the wonderful web wizard. As always, Larry's taking a bit of a hiatus to work out some personal stuff and some family stuff in the next week or two. But he's in the wing, trust me, and he'll be back stronger than ever in just a little while, okay? All right, thanks as well to all the people out there sending art and music and poetry. Thank you. Send more. Send more. We'll find a place for it on the website. We'll share it with other people, okay? Check it out. Let me know what you think about it. Go over to the web at Mike Hagan, MikeHagan.com. You'll have access to everything that I'm doing over there. And take a look and see. Let me know. Share your thoughts with us, too, okay? The forum is always busy. There's always interesting topics being discussed over there, news and otherwise. Actually, more than I can keep up with these days, for sure. There's a live chat room up and running right now. Got a few people in there that are peeking in and talking about what's happening already. A couple of nice notes actually about the music, John. Anyway, I'll go in there in the next hour or two to get questions and comments from you guys as well, okay? I encourage my guests as well as listeners to join us over there in the chat room. It's great during the live broadcast because regardless of where you are, whether you're here in Columbia or in the general mid-Missouri vicinity here, or if you're listening from, you know, Vladivostok, it doesn't matter. You can hear the program live, and you can join us in the chat room and participate in the program. So do that if you get a chance, okay? Like I say, guests and listeners as well. All right, my email address, by the way, for contact, Orbit Radio, O-R-B-I-T-R-A-D-I-O, orbitradio@AOL.com. Send email to me, all right? If you have something to say, share it, all right? Same thing with my guests and the musicians that are on this program. If you like what you hear, if you don't like what you hear, contact us. Let us know, all right? And share your opinions and your voice. You know, the web now gives us this amazing opportunity to not only hear and experience other people's ideas and art and all this sort of thing, but it also gives us the opportunity to share our own opinions. So, you know, don't just use it as a vehicle that moves in one direction. Use it as a two-way vehicle. Get information, get art, get off, you know, and then share it with others, right? That's the way the web works, and that's the way I'd like to see at least my listeners using it. So, like I say, I encourage you all to send me email, and I encourage you to send email to my guests and anybody else who's on this program. Okay, for me, it's orbitradio@AOL.com. One more time on the web, you can always reach me at www.mikehagan.com. And John, by the way, do you guys have you got a MySpace page or a web page,
yeah,
or what do you got?
MySpace.com/ John Henry and the Engine, and being an A-N-D.
All right, John Henry and, spelled A-N-D, John Henry and the Engine, MySpace.com/ John Henry and the Engine.
All one word, or okay. JohnHenryandTheEngine.com.
JohnHenryandTheEngine.com. Okay, both things. You can go to the website directly, or you can hook up with them through MySpace, okay? Same thing for me, you know, MikeHagan.com, and I also do the MySpace Radio Orbit thing, all right? Which I used to sort of poo-poo, and I made jokes about it on the air or whatever, but the MySpace thing has actually been a great way to reach people and a great way to communicate, and I'm fully into it, and I think it's a great tool.
It's totally essential for bands right now.
Yeah, and there's a tremendous amount of stuff being shared through that and other vehicles. I know Facebook's a big one, and there's a few other ones, but anyway, great stuff, and I'm glad that you guys and lots of other people are using it. I mean, talk about using the technology, you know?
It's an information network with the demographic that we're interested in.
Sure, sure.
I wish I would have created it.
No, see, then you got the hassle of having to deal with it. What you want to do is just take advantage of it, you see.
Well,
you want to make music, right?
Yeah, but it's cool.
It'd be Tom.
It'd be cool. Yeah, Tom. Everybody's first friend.
All right.
Only.
All right, so check these guys out, by the way. We'll have another song from John here in a minute, but let me go and mention a little bit about upcoming guests, because this is sort of an exciting time for me. There's a lot of good things going on. So, John, back in a minute with you guys, okay?
All right,
upcoming guests. Tonight, as I mentioned, Judith Ann Brown, the daughter of John Marco Allegro. She wrote a book called John Marco Allegro, The Maverick of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And she's wonderful, and her father was doing work that has yet to be acknowledged, and but has yet to be forgotten as well, okay? Next week, I'm very excited to have John Sheliak, Dr. John Sheliak, on the program. John is a nuclear physicist, and he's also a PhD mathematician, but the reason that I'm interested, you know, there's a lot of those, the reason that I'm interested in John's work is because he was very influential in taking the original mathematics that Terence McKenna had come up with regard to something that he had called novelty theory, and was interested in a new definition of time, essentially. But Terence was on sort of soft mathematical ground, and because he really wasn't a mathematician, you know, at the heart of what he was hardly mathematics, although he was able to express mathematics better than 99% of the people out there, he still wasn't, you know, a technical, theoretical mathematician. And so when he developed novelty theory and the time wave, he made a few mistakes, frankly. And he was, you know, dragged over the coals about it, too. Well, in walked John Sheliak, you know, a mathematician who did have the credentials and did have the background that was able to allow him to look at the work that Terence had already done, refine it a little bit, and show that it was actually on firm mathematical ground. So John Sheliak, who's been sort of off the radar for quite some time, will be back on the radar next week on Radio Orbit. And we'll speak with John about his work and the Time Wave and everything that he's thought about and worked on since he originally did that work in the 80s and in the 90s. And he hasn't been idle. Trust me, John Sheliak has not been idle. So we'll hear about what he's up to. He's got a new website that he's going to be launching very soon, and we'll sort of have an exclusive with John Sheliak, Dr. John Sheliak, next week, okay? And by the way, this show tonight with Judith Ann Brown, Judith has never been interviewed by anyone, not on the radio, not in print, not on the television, nowhere. And she deserves to be interviewed by lots more people than me, all right? On the 5th of March, it's a special day for lots of reasons, Ralph Metzner will be on the program. Again, Dr. Ralph Metzner. And we'll have the music of Noah Earle on the 5th of May as well. So Dr. Ralph Metzner, for those of you in the know, if you listen to this program, I don't have to tell you who Ralph Metzner is. If you don't know who he is, find out. On the 12th, we'll have Willie Gaspar. We'll be talking about the sun. And we'll be talking about, lots of things. History, mythology, and the sun, with Willie Gaspar. He's an associate of John Jenkins, and we've talked for actually about a year now, and not really sure where I stand on Willie's ideas, like any. You know, they're a little bit controversial, and he's sort of a doomer. He's more of a doom and gloomer than some of the people that I have in this program, but he's a smart guy with a lot of research behind what he talks about, and we'll let him air it out on the 12th of March, okay, Willie Gaspar. On the 19th, it's funny, I'm looking at my notes here, and I have March 19th, Jose Arguelles, and in parentheses I have the word hopefully. Well, I didn't update my notes. I should have removed the hopefully, because I got an email yesterday confirming that Dr. Jose Arguelles, and I don't like calling Jose Arguelles a doctor, frankly, because he's more like a shaman. But regardless of how you address him, Jose Arguelles will be on the program live from New Zealand, as a matter of fact, on March 19th. I was planning to do a special show for the spring equinox, which of course occurs on the 21st or the 22nd this year of March, and this is a special equinox show, Jose Arguelles, and I hope you all appreciate what you're going to hear that night, all right? On the 26th, Eric John Phelps, for the conspiracy-minded of you out there, we'll talk about the Vatican and some of the business that they've been up to for many, many years, okay? Lots of other stuff coming up. Dennis, of course, Dr. Dennis, back sometime in the spring. Who knows with him, though? He's very busy these days, and unless something really sort of a note comes up, Dennis just likes to sort of hang in the wings, but I'm in touch with him frequently, and if anything does come up, I'll make sure I share it with you. Paul Stamets, although we haven't confirmed a date, and I'm never really sure if we're going to be able to work it out, but with Paul, I'm really hoping that we can, and he should be on the program sometime in the spring, and hopefully in the summer, if not in the spring, but we are talking, and he agreed to be on the program. It's just a matter of sort of getting him, you know, tied down to a date, because he's a real busy guy, okay? Patrick Flanagan, Susan Weed, Barbara Ehrenreich, all people that I'm trying to get on the program. And believe it or not, Dr. Jane Goodall. In a strange set of synchronicities, I sort of was pointed towards Jane Goodall. And she's a remarkable woman, if you're not familiar with her work, and a lifetime of just incredible work. So hopefully sometime in the next, I don't know, few months, Dr. Jane Goodall. All right? All that stuff coming up on Orbit, and great independent music as well. And so I need to take a breather here and get me a glass of water, I think, and hand it over to my friend John Henry again, play another song for us. Let's see, John, we got time for one. We'll play one more for sure, John, and probably another one in 10 or 15 minutes or so, okay?
Okay.
What do you want to play?
I'll play a song called Midnight Eyes.
Midnight Eyes, okay. One more time, everybody, John Henry and the Engine, at the Blue Fugue on the 23rd of February, this Friday night. And
tickets?
Yeah, tickets. Actually, give me a call. The first caller at 573-874-5676, 573-874-5676. call me right now, or as soon as John starts playing here, and I'll pick up the phone and write down your name and your phone number, and I'll get you a set of tickets for the show on Friday night at the Blue Fugue. John Henry and the Engine, the Feed, and Hazard to your booty. You got to love it.
They're
right?
Hazardous.
They are hazardous. The whole gang's hazardous, trust me, and the phone's ringing already. So, John wants to do something. I'll grab the phone here. This is one more time.
Midnight Eyes.
Midnight Eyes. John Henry from John Henry and the Engine.
Well, I looked into your eyes, trying to get back what I put in. That dark river that runs deep into the night, follow where your current did flow. I was wrapped up in your ways, still I did pull tight. For everyone has a space that needs to be filled. Now I need reaction from those midnight eyes as the December winds blow cold. Mud off your feet, preaching flowers out of breath. I wear that dark river needs that cold hard ground. I'm on my way back down. The road that trails off to sits up high up on that hill with a picture window. Well, I'm all you wish to see through the view of those midnight eyes. And you hate to sleep alone.
Midnight Eyes, that's John Henry, another song. Is that something that you're going to record, or is that something that's on your
CD?
Yeah,
it's on the record.
That's
right.
Actually,
it's weird. That's like one of my favorite songs.
Yeah, it's a great song.
I really like that one for some reason.
All right, and again, you'll probably have a chance to hear that on Friday night, the 23rd of February, at the Blue Fugue, John Henry and the Engine, and the Feed. And
the Hazard to
Who
your
else?
Booty.
Oh, hold on. I'm in an infinite loop there. Hazard to Your Booty.
Booty.
I like to say booty in the air.
Those guys are sweet. They're all good.
Yeah, it's going to be a great show, I'm sure, and you can check that out on the 23rd at the Blue Fugue, as I mentioned. Okay, also, one thing I want to also say is at Kevin's World on the 24th, that's on Saturday down there on 9th Street, Kevin Kelvin, you might know him from the station here, but anyway, there's a thing going on called the One Drum Challenge. And all I know is the guy's name is Jeremy. I've met him once or twice. I don't know his last name. But Jeremy's running this thing, the One Drum Challenge. Basically, you just go down to Kevin's World on the 24th on Saturday. And whoever can do the greatest thing with one drum, they win the one drum challenge. And there's all kinds of different people that are going to be rolling down there to do their thing on that particular drum, myself included maybe. So anyway, that's on the 24th on Kevin's World. You can check out, well, I don't know where the hell you'll find out about it. All I know is that it's happening. So call Kevin or go down to Kevin's World on 9th Street and find out. And also, I want to mention one other thing. It's sort of in the future here, a little bit further than normal that I talk about. But on the 4th of May, basically 2 months from now, on a Friday night, we're having a benefit for KOPN at the Blue Fugue. Hopefully, we'll bring this whole thing together. But John Henry and his band are going to be there. And they've graciously agreed to show up along with a lineup of a whole bunch of other bands, John. I'm not sure who we're going to get, but I guarantee
it's
going to be outrageous.
Gonna be quality, though,
it is going to be awesome. And we'll do it'll be an early Friday night. We'll start things right after working hours, do a happy hour thing, start at 5 o'clock and go until they shut us down and have a whole bunch of different music and try to raise some money for KOPN. So anyway, all that stuff's coming up and lots of other things going on around town. If you're a fan of the arts, if you're a fan of music, you know, shut off the tube, get outside, do something fun. The weather's getting a little bit more cooperative, and, you know, spring's on the way, so get out and see some live music and shake your booty a little bit.
61 degrees on Friday.
I know. It's going to be incredible. I'm so excited about it. I've been just frozen out.
It's like,
you know,
a heat wave.
Yeah, it's great. So, all right, listen, John, give me another 5 minutes to take care of a couple things here, and then we'll play one more on the way out, okay?
Thank you. Yeah.
All right, everybody, one more time. John Henry and the Engine. Thanks, John.
Yep.
And on the 23rd, of course, this Friday at the Blue Fugue, John Henry and a couple other great bands, okay? All right, let's see. Space weather tonight. You know, I'm sort of on a bummer about space weather since Comet McNaught sort of left our neck of the woods. It was so dramatic for a while that now, you know, I'm just sort of anticlimactic, everything that's happening. But one of the things that was very, well, pretty, if nothing else, when the sun is setting and as the moon is sort of following right now, you'll see a wonderful picture of Venus and little crescent moon having a little close encounter right in that rosy glow of the sunset. Tonight it was beautiful. It was incredible for the last couple nights. And we've been lucky to have clear skies over the last few nights in Missouri. So you can see this great picture in the sky of the planet Venus and the moon in the lovely sunset. You'll be able to see it for the next few nights as well. Okay. As always, you got your random asteroids and comets that are doing their thing all around the solar system. I didn't go too deeply into space weather this afternoon when I was sort of getting ready for the show, but I did go deeply enough to realize that there's nothing too stunning to talk about, so we'll move on a little bit further, and I'll mention a little bit more about the show tonight, and we'll have one more song from John in a few minutes, but this woman, Judith Ann Brown, it's really interesting because she, you know, she's not out there looking for fanfare or anything like that. She has a regular career, and she's an English woman and lives in Manchester. But she wrote this book about her father because she felt that that he had been, you know, unfairly treated, frankly, and that the way that his work was eventually recognized or discredited, I guess, by the established institutions, was something that needed to be, well, at least spoken to. And for those of us that are familiar with this stuff, you know, we know about John Marco Allegro. And it's really interesting the work that Allegro did because, you see, in 1960, he was the one man on the planet. He was the main dude who was, according to everybody else, the guy that had to be on this team. He was the world's leading expert on these ancient languages, you know, Assyrian, Aramaic, ancient Hebrew, Coptic. He could read Sumerian texts. I mean, he was considered the guy. And all of the work that he did up until 1970 is considered remarkable. You know, it's one of these deals where, well, everything he did before this date was brilliant, and then after this date, it was not brilliant anymore. Well, why? Because, well, for one reason, because the message after that particular date became a message that was unpalatable, you know, to the current power structure. And at least that's, you know, the story that Judith Ann Brown relates in John Marco Allegro, the maverick of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the further any of us look into these things with an open mind, with an unbiased, you know, with an unbiased attitude, going into the thing with no presuppositions, ideological or otherwise, and I think that you'll probably come out with the same conclusions. But anyway, he was a scholar, a linguist, a philologist, and essentially a rock star in the 1960s. I mean, he's on the cover of Time magazine and whatever, you know, being interviewed all over the place. John Marco Allegro. Now nobody knows his name. Well, not nobody. Somebody's. And somebody's more are going to learn about it tonight. Okay? All right, let me call my friend John Henry and say, sneak your butt back in here and play another song for me. We'll take a break. After that, I'll come back, talk a little bit about some things that are in the news. And then at the top of the hour, we'll do it up, and we'll have an interview with Judith Ann Brown, the daughter of John Marco Allegro. And it's an interview that I did, I recorded actually about 3 weeks ago. Judith was not interested in doing a live program, and I recorded it, and I'll play it for you in just a little while here, okay? In the meantime, we will hear another piece of music here from my friend John. What do you got for us, John?
This song is called Here We Are in Paradise.
Here We Are in Paradise. Isn't that the truth? KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM.
Running through my own backyard with the flag, streets of gold, never seemed true to me. In the air I hear the church bells ringing away. Will they ring now? Like the Garden of Eden, with the fruit still on the vine. Running away, push it off to the slain, it's wiped away. In the air, I hear the voices shouting away. We're the fallen now. Like the Garden of Eden, right before the flood. Thank you.
All right, there you have it. One more time, John Henry from John Henry and the Engine.
Thanks, thank you
John.
Very much. Mike.
Thank you very much for the wonderful music. And if you want to see more of it, everybody, on Friday night, this coming Friday, the 23rd of Feb, down at the Blue Fugue down there on 9th Street, John Henry, The Feed, and Hazard to Your Booty. Going to be a great show, and I hope hope you guys have a great time.
Right? Thank you. Thank you.
All right, and a new CD coming out. We got work going on with Home Tone Records. We got a deal going with MTV. There's lots of stuff going on for the band, so congratulations, John.
Yeah, thank you very much. We're really happy.
All right, we'll be in touch with you, and just keep me up with what's going on, okay?
Cool.
All right, everybody, that's John and the rest of the gang. Thanks for coming down, guys.
Excellent.
All right, cheers. All right, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. It's about, 11:49 in the p.m. now. We got about 10 minutes before the top of the hour. We'll start things off with Judith Ann Brown in just a few minutes. The interview that I did with her is about an hour and 10 minutes long. We'll take one break in between, and so we'll probably start things off here in just a few minutes. I'm peeking in at the news, though, and looking at the forum, see if there's anything that's relevant that I should talk about before we go to Judith. But I think what we'll probably do is I've got some other music tonight that we're going to sort of change gears with and play after the top of the hour. And it's another friend of mine who has a musical project that they call iTom Lab. That's right, iTom Lab. And so we'll hear some iTom Lab in the next few minutes probably too. And I think I might do that actually now so that I can go say goodbye to my friends. So hang in there just a minute. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And this is a song called Walk In on the Equation. It's iTom Lab, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. We'll be back with Judith Ann Brown in just a little bit. Well, as you can tell, the music, as I've been having troubles, you know, for the last couple weeks, same business tonight. So, watch this, though. I was sort of ready for it. So, here's another song from iTom Lab. It's called Perfect Paradigm. Let's try it this time. It's Mike. You're listening to KOPN Radio Orbit. Back in a few minutes, we'll have Judith Ann Brown.
actually most minds what people make it out to be. People create their own reality.
Music is the universal language.
ITOM Lab. All right, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Great stuff there from the guys from ITOM. And got a great interview coming for you here in just a minute. Judith Ann Brown, the daughter of John Marco Allegro. I'll air that for you. Not right now, but just in a minute, okay? I want to say a couple more things here before we go to that. And, well, first of all, I wanted to update you on space weather. I got a call here in the last few minutes or so, not long ago, that somebody saw a nice fireball blazing through the sky here in mid-Missouri. So we got meteor showers in Missouri tonight. It was sort of reported as being in sort of a direct overhead position moving toward the north-northwest. So keep your eyes out for flying balls of fire tonight, okay? And I sort of like that stuff. The more extreme and interesting stuff I see in the sky, the more excited I get, but tends to scare other people as well. So, anyway, whether you like it or not, things flying around out there. All right, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia. We'll do a little bit of news and stuff when we come back from this interview, but we're going to do it right now. Judith Ann Brown, the daughter of John Marco Allegro. I mentioned a little bit about John earlier in the program, and, you know, I have for a few weeks here. He was quite amazing, and actually someone who, up until he wrote one particular book, was considered, you know, tops in his field. Then he wrote the wrong book, and all of a sudden he was no longer considered that. But he was amazing, and we'll let Judy tell the rest of the story, or at least a part of the story, in a minute here. I have one brief recommendation. Judith has an English accent, and the audio quality on the morning that we did this interview was not the best I've ever had. It wasn't that bad, but it wasn't the best. And you may have to pay a bit closer attention than normal. Okay, it's kind of fitting, actually, considering her father's work, all about translation. You know what I mean? But anyway, listen closely, and I'll be back with you in a bit, okay? It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit. It's KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. We'll be back in just a little while. In the meantime, this is Judith Ann Brown.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Radio Orbit. My guest this evening is a remarkable woman. Her name is Judith Ann Brown, and she's the author of an amazing book entitled John Marco Allegro, The Maverick of the Dead Sea Scrolls. She's also the daughter of that same John Marco Allegro, and it's a privilege and a pleasure to speak with her. So without further delay, let's do just that. Judith Ann Brown, welcome to Radio Orbit. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
What I'd like to do off the bat here is start off with a little bit of background information, a little bit of framework about yourself and your father. Why don't you start off by just telling us, who was John Marco Allegro?
Well, John was a scholar of the Dead Sea Scrolls. He made his name through asking awkward questions about the scrolls and their significance for the development of religion in particular. This started in the middle of the 1950s, and he was still asking awkward questions and making a fuss about this and that right up to 1988 when he died. In particular, because the scrolls had still not been published at that stage.
Maybe you could tell us a little bit about the man that you knew as a father before we talk about how he got involved with the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Well, he was dad and did all the usual things while we were children. Mm-hmm. We didn't talk very much about his work at all until he was a great deal older. I really tried to keep it separate from us. My brother and I were tremendously proud about his expeditions to Jordan because we used to load up the Land Rovers in our backyard and set off every few years.
Where did you guys live at the time?
Oh, we lived in a Macclesfield in Cheshire.
Mm-hmm.
And later moved into Derbyshire, which is only a few miles away, so we've lived in the middle of England. so that he could work at Manchester University.
And you're still in the UK?
Yes, I live in the same village where we used to live in the 1960s.
Amazing. All right, let's move on a little bit and talk about the early career of your dad. He was involved with the church, at least some sect of the Christian church, before he got directly involved with the scrolls. Could you talk a little bit about that early time?
Yes, he was serving in the Royal Navy during the war, and while he was there, he started wondering what everything was about.
And this is World War II, of course.
Yes, that's right. And he found that the things that meant most to him came through the fellowship he experienced as part of the Methodist group on board ship. He decided he wanted to train to be a minister on leaving the Navy. So he started at the Theological College in Manchester to train for the Methodist ministry. He got about halfway through that when he found that his interests were diverging. This is because part of the course was to study languages like Greek, Latin, Hebrew, Arabic, Aramaic, and so on at the university so that he could better understand the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
But he found that while studying the languages, he started to ask questions about their accepted translations and interpretations. And this really tracked his belief because he started questioning how far he could truthfully try to preach a text that he wasn't really sure of the translation of.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So he went on to further his knowledge of those languages?
Yes, he transferred to the university full-time for a degree course in Oriental Studies, which was basically Hebrew, Aramaic, Arabic. And things went on from there. That was his chief interest.
Okay, and give me an idea about his age at this time. How far along in his career was he?
Oh, he'd be in his mid-20s there, because he'd left school at 16, mm-hmm. started working in an insurance office. He had no particular further or higher education after school, but having been in the Navy, there was the opportunity for soldiers, sailors, airmen to resume their education if it had been interrupted by the war, and he took advantage of this partly by going to the university. So he was able to get some grant. But he was a bit older than most of the students. He'd still only be about 24, 25 when he came out, I think.
Okay. Somewhere along the way, he meets Joan Lawrence. Maybe a little bit about Joan.
Oh, he met Joan while he was in the Navy. His ship was being refitted in Glasgow, which is where she lived. And I met Joan at this youth club. He started dating her then, and then for the whole of the following year, while his ship was touring the Pacific, he used to write letters back. They exchanged them at least once a week.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, she kept all the letters he wrote to her, though I can't say that he kept any of the letters she wrote to him.
Is that right?
For reason or another. So I've been able to draw on those to give me an idea of how his ideas developed and what he was thinking and talking about while he was still in the Navy.
I have to tell you that it's a thrill to read some of the direct correspondence that you include in your book, because you really get a feel for the personal nature of the whole business that was going on at that time, including the relationship that your father and Joan had as that developed. So it was really cool that you were able to include some of those letters directly in the book.
Yes, they show his personality and the fervor with which he went into everything, whether it was a love affair or pursuing a career in the church.
How significant was Joan to your father's life?
Well, tremendously. She was the anchor, really, and she always supported him in every sense. In one sense, she was the main breadwinner all the time he was studying, and she continued with a much steadier job than he ever managed to get throughout their lives, really. Whatever he did, he would discuss it with her, and whether or not she fully agreed or understood, she would support him, and this went on throughout their life.
Now, is Joan your mother?
Yes.
Yes, okay. All right, well, thank you for that. And let's now talk a little bit about the Dead Sea Scrolls. Let's start from maybe the discovery. Can you tell us a little bit about how the scrolls were discovered?
It started in 1947. There was a Bedouin goat herd looking for a lost goat or sheep. It was very hot. He couldn't find the goat, but he did find a cave. He chucked a stone into the cave, as boys do, and it hit something that sounded odd, so he scrambled up to have a look. When he had a proper look, going back the next day with a friend, they were a bit puzzled. They found jars and lots of fragments of material in them. No treasure or gold or silver or any of the thing they were probably hoping for.
Right.
But they took the contents of the jars back to camp, and in due course, they were taken, these the scrolls I'm talking about, they were taken to the local market and to get some opinion as to their worth or any possible use they could have.
What part of the world was this in?
Oh, sorry, it was in Jordan.
Okay.
The Judean Desert, and quite near the shores of the Dead Sea.
Okay, and of course,
it was still Jordan at that time, before Israel had taken over a part of the country.
Okay. So your father was working in the Methodist ministry. Was he still in the Navy at this time?
No, he'd left the Navy, and he'd become a trainee probationer with the Methodist Church. In Scotland to start with, but this was just to gain a bit of experience before going to theological college. So that this was 1947 and 47, I think, after he'd been left the Navy for a year or two.
Okay, so from this position with the Methodist ministry in the United States, no, I guess this was in England, obviously.
Yes.
How then does he make it onto the team to investigate originally the Dead Sea Scrolls? And maybe you could talk a little bit about, well, we'll go into the team members and that a little bit later, but just maybe tell us a little bit about how he gets from the Methodist ministry to the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Right. He'd given up training for the Methodist ministry when he decided to concentrate full-time on his degree course at Manchester University,
okay.
Oriental Studies.
Mm-hmm.
He got that very successfully. First class, then he went on to an MA degree with a dissertation. From that, he was starting a PhD, a doctorate. He was sent to Oxford for this, and it was about 4 or 5 months into the PhD when the team in Jerusalem who were in charge of the Dead Sea Scrolls decided they needed some extra help.
Mm-hmm.
The thing was that one of the caves that had by then been excavated was full of fragments, thousands and thousands of dusty little snippets of scroll,
mm-hmm.
and they'd been collected up as best they could, but it was going to take years for many more people than were currently involved in it to sort them out, put them together, translate them, something else.
So really,
the call went out to various universities throughout the world. In England, Oxford, whose professor was G.R. Driver, was the main centre for research into Hebrew and Aramaic, this sort of biblical language.
Mm-hmm.
And John was the rising star of the department. He was studying by himself for the PhD, but his supervisor was the Professor Driver, and Driver recommended that he should have the chance to go out to Jerusalem to take part in this work on the new Dead Sea Scrolls.
Amazing.
This would be in 1953, because he spent nearly a year, 1953-4, you know, the academic year, in Jerusalem with the team.
Okay, and in Jerusalem, is he then introduced to the rest of the team members that are already working on the scrolls?
Yeah, he was one of the first, actually.
The
founders were, the founding members of the team were Father Roland DeVoe and Joseph Milik, who were so connected with the Ecole Biblique, the institution that was dealing with them mainly. The other people there at this time were Frank Cross, an American scholar, and in fact these three, Milik, John, and Frank, were the first members. They were later joined by several other people. But, he was one of the first.
Okay. Out of the other three that you mentioned, were they... Is this a Jordanian ministry that they were working through? Or I guess I'm curious as to sort of their ideology. And where did they come from? What sort of background did those other men come from?
It wasn't Jordanian, except that Jordan ran the Palestine Archaeological Museum, where the scrolls were housed and where they set up this scrollery to deal with the fragments. The Ecole Biblique was, I believe, funded by the Vatican. It was a Roman Catholic institution. Which had been there for centuries, I think. And they were given leave to bring international scholars, presumably through the Jordanian authorities, you know.
All right. Well, there were some, according to the book at least, and I'm not sure about how it developed in the future, but there were at least 900 different scrolls that were found throughout a whole network of caves.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that only a couple hundred of those were biblical, quote-unquote, in nature. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the balance of the material that was found there. What was all of it about?
Well, there were several biblical books. In particular, there were several copies of what was apparently the favorite reading of the Jewish sect that compiled and wrote the scrolls, such as books of Isaiah, Hosea, and Daniel, one of the others. There were also apocryphal texts, which were books of biblical type writings. They haven't actually been included in the Bible, but they were obviously studied at that time, which was about 2,000 years ago, by the Jewish sects who produced the scrolls. The other main type of material was the sectarian material, which described the life and beliefs and practices of the group who most people, fairly large majority of scholars, and especially the people like Tavol and Milik and also John, the people on the team, most assumed that they were Essenes.
Mm-hmm.
The Essenes were a sect that was described by various contemporary writers such as Josephus as living an ascetic life in a community by the shores of the Dead Sea, which corresponded to where the scrolls were found at Kibbeth Qumran.
Mm-hmm.
And the sectarian documents described the rules for living in this community, and also some of their beliefs in the messianic nature of their belief. For example, they have the war scroll, which described the what they believed was about to happen, massive conflict between the children of night, meaning themselves, and Satan's children of darkness. They lived in perpetual fear and expectation of the last coming, and they were apparently all well prepared for it to the extent of drawing up battle lines and predicting exactly what would happen and when. It was all to depend on the forces of angels and the spirits being sent by God to help the right side win.
Remarkable. You know, I made a note here that just sort of caught my attention as I looked to the sidebar of my piece of paper here. But maybe you could mention really quickly about John's photographs. It's a little bit of a left turn, but I know that he was really interested in photographing everything that he came across, and eventually that became greatly appreciated, I think.
Yes, he did. He photographed everything. He didn't tell my mother much about this, probably because of the cost that was a great concern to both of them at the time. But he built up an enormous library of slides of the fragments and the scenes, the ruins, which were left with he did. And nearly all of them have been housed at the Allegro Qumran collection at Manchester University. Now, he took them first so that with the idea that he would be using them himself for his research and to back up the personal glimpses of the scrolls he was having, because he foresaw that the work would go on for long after the year that he was commissioned to go out there.
Right, right.
Also for his own lectures and books and things like that. But also he wanted everything to be available to future scholars, and with this in mind, the family agreed that they should be there accessible to everybody through the university looking after them. So that's 4,000 slides, I think, at the moment.
Is any of that available for the general public to take a look at anyhow?
Well, they can, anybody who goes to Manchester University can, I suppose. But it's kept on microfiche.
Mm-hmm.
And through the archives at the museum, anybody can view them or copy them, purchase them. There's a lot involved, but one would expect that.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the actual nuts and bolts of this business. I mean, your dad was actually in these caves, digging around with his hands, and is this how this basically went about?
He didn't do very much of the digging. Most of the people who did the digging were the Bedouin, supplemented by some official archaeologists who were several steps behind the locals. The Arab merchantmen would find this a very useful supplement to their income.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They'd bring in collections of scroll fragments as they found them and sell them to the authorities in Jerusalem or Bethlehem, wherever they...
Oh, wow, so they're sort of like independent agents out there collecting stuff and then turning them in for cash.
Yes, it was all rather a scramble. It wasn't very systematic.
Mm-hmm.
But that's pretty well what it came to, yes. The authorities did try to control access to the caves, but... to say it was rather a scramble, and the natives who were the Bedouin who'd been roaming there all their life, you know, they had a much better idea of where everything was.
Right, right.
And in fact, they were invaluable. I mean, they had to be employed by the authorities to make any official digs,
mm-hmm.
excavations.
And much of the work that comes afterwards is sort of like putting a puzzle together.
Yes, that's nice, like a massive jigsaw puzzle. Spread out the fragments in what they call the scrollery part of the museum, and just spent hours poring over them until they found out which ones belong together and how they related to each other, that it was backbreaking work.
Oh, I can't imagine. All right, the first book in what I think it was maybe 1956, is that when the Dead Sea Scrolls was written?
Yes, that's...
Okay, and what was...
It was meant to be a popular guide.
Yeah, what was the nature of that book?
Well, it's a popular guide to the scrolls. It's not meant to be particularly scholarly, though it's very informative and accurate. It was to interest people at large in the Dead Sea Scrolls. John felt that they were so important and so significant for everybody's understanding of their religion and their culture, the whole background, that everybody should be able to look at them,
mm-hmm.
to understand about them. So he interested Penguin publishers in the idea and just went ahead and wrote it very quickly, very efficiently. And it was an immediate bestseller, to his great surprise and joy.
Mm-hmm. Something happens, though, along the way. Your father became increasingly concerned about the way that the scrolls had been handled in an original sense, and he was concerned about access, open access to scholarly individuals and that sort of thing for research. He wrote another book that was called The Dead Sea Scrolls,
a reappraisal. Maybe you could talk a little bit about his mindset and where this was going.
That was actually just through a vision of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Mm-hmm.
But by then, it was several years later, and several things had happened, so he was more willing to include rather more controversial material in it and tell a bit more about the circumstances of the discovery and the editing and everything else. But it is very much built on the previous book, so I don't think he counted it as a separate one, really.
Okay.
By then, he had rather fallen out with the team, or most of it anyway. Various rifts began developing quite early, from 1956 onwards, and they really diverged in their attitudes and interests. The whole approach to the scrolls, which unfortunately left him rather out on a limb.
Was it a professional rivalry of sorts between the members of the team, or was it more like an ideological issue?
It wasn't really a rivalry. They were great friends, at least while they were there. It was a marvelous time he had there. It was ideological. He couldn't understand why they were so unwilling to talk about them. Really, they seemed very loath to discuss, at least to discuss in public, any ideas that might shake the current general acceptance of the gospel story, of the unique historical happening. John, on the other hand, found that through the scrolls, they were casting some doubt on the, a different perspective on the background to Jesus' birth and his education and his whole career. He wanted to talk about this because he felt it was important.
Mm-hmm.
To get things straight, and so that people shouldn't just accept everything they were told. It was something he never wanted to do, accepting things he was told. He just wanted to work it out for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But he was really surprised that the rest of the team weren't so willing to engage in dialogue about this. What he said wasn't actually all that new. People before John had drawn the parallels between what they were finding in the scrolls about Esther's practice and doctrine and the Christian story. But I think the problem with John was he wanted to talk about it in public, and he was going rather too fast for the rest of the team. It was a much more cautious approach, and also very much represented the Christian, in most cases the Roman Catholic approach, was not too happy about anything that they felt might shake people's belief.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about the Copper Scroll.
Well, the Copper Scroll, unlike all the others, was made of copper rather than parchment.
Okay, so many of the scrolls were made of parchment.
Yes.
Okay, and this one is different. It's made out of metal.
Yes. The Copper Scroll was unique in that it was it was made of two rolls of which had been made of copper, which had been engraved with writing, rolled up and left in the corner of a cave three. It was a great problem because it couldn't be unrolled.
Hmm.
It was amazing really that it survived at all, but as it had survived, it had oxidized so badly that it was completely stiff, as well as crusted with dust and grime, and nobody could think how to unroll it. It clearly had writing inside it. The odd words were visible from the outside, but it was a great puzzle. Anyway, it lay in the vaults in the museum in Jordan for a couple of years while scholars all over the world wondered what to do with it. The first idea was that it should be sent to either Harvard or University in Baltimore, Johns Hopkins University, for unrolling. The scientists both there and in Jordan, and in Britain for that matter, were teasing out whether they might possibly be able to unroll it, soften it, harden it, pry it open, nothing else. They couldn't come to any decision. John suggested that first the British Museum might have the expertise to handle it. They weren't that interested, he rather doubted it. So So he then suggested Manchester. And because nobody else had been able to think how to unroll it, the Jordanian authorities said, well, if you could find somebody who thinks they can do it, for the track quality, you know, make inquiries and we'll think about it.
Mm-hmm.
So he did. He approached various people in Manchester, various engineering firms and the University Department of Metallurgy. But where he got the best response was from what was then the College of Technology, who were incredibly enthusiastic and quite convinced that they could design a machine that would be able to open it one way or another. He was so convinced by this that he wrote back recommending it to the authorities in Jordan, and the upshot was it came to the College of Technology in November of 1955 to be opened there by Professor Wright Baker.
How did they do it?
Well, Wright Baker devised a machine using various things like dentist drills, a spindle, a rod, something that looks like Meccano at this day and age, but it was the best they had, you know, newly designed for the purpose. It suspended the roll on a rod guided by Wright Baker himself. A very delicate knife was run along the side of it, taking off one layer at a time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
John standing by would dust it and put it in a special holder that Wright Baker had also devised and made out of plaster, as a sort of cast in each piece. Then with gentle brushing and cleaning, John was able to make a transcription of what was written there and eventually translate it as best he could.
Amazing.
This was only ever going to be a provisional translation. He knew quite well that his job was not to make the official version. It was incredibly exciting because nobody had seen inside this scroll for 2,000 years.
My gosh.
And it was a great honor for him to be able to do it, especially when he found out what it said.
Oh, astonishing. All right, everybody. Hi, it's Mike. We're going to take a little bit of a break here from our interview with Judith Ann Brown, the daughter of John Marco Allegro. You're listening to it on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, Mid-Missouri source for in-depth news, diverse talk, and a world of music. You got it here coming to you live every Monday night from 11 p.m. until 2 a.m. in the morning. And we'll come back with Judith in a minute, but let's play a song here from iTom Lab, and I think you'll like it. This is the John Allegro mix. And I don't know exactly what the song is called. It's brand new. And wonderful stuff. Check it out.
The category under which this paper is included, Historical Problems, assumes the self-evidential thesis that there are elements of the gospel narratives which do not ring true. But any constructive analysis of the New Testament records can't rest content with a simple arithmetical equation. Fact equals the possible minus the less likely and downright impossible. That is, that if we go on peeling away the skins of improbability from the onion, we shall end eventually with a small kernel of historical fact on which to build some new theory. Be distilled by skilled interpreters, well versed in the art of rabbinic exegesis, as well as the abracadabra Gnostic mysticism. Secret passwords and sayings. The formulae for medicaments and hallucinatory drugs. The therapia in practice and prescription. Not everything that is true needs necessarily to be divulged to all men. The sacred mushroom and the cross, the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Christian myth, Christian myth. able to break open documentary seals, to terrify the world's rulers with its wrath. The Dead Sea Scrolls and the Christian Myth. Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. The Dead Sea Scrolls and the Christian Myth. In the scrolls to the Christian story, they are for the most part more likely to be in the nature of a common mythology. And seek in the documents detailed correspondences of time, place, and persons is to misunderstand the nature of the Qumran texts and their authors' attitudes to history. Not everything that is true needs necessarily to be divulged to all men, 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 to all men.
ITOM Lab. I think that one's called Secret Passwords. But regardless of what it's called, wonderful, great stuff. Thanks for the music. ITOM Lab, you can find information about them and all the other musicians that are featured on the program here by going to my archives at www.mikehagan.com. And you can either go to the program archives or you can go to the music archives if you're interested in hearing some of the music that has been played on the program, okay? KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, and we'll return to our interview in just a moment with Judith Ann Brown. Let's talk a little bit real quickly about this issue of translation. I know a lot of people, this is one of the arguments that's used all the time, the fact that very few people in general really know what these languages are saying. And so there becomes a question of, well, how do you really trust the translation? Could you talk a little bit about that? I mean, did the guys get together and say, okay, well, what do you think this means and what do I think this means, and just sort of hash it out, or how did it work?
Yes, after all, John went into the whole business because he could see various ways of translating the ancient Hebrew. I think they were the foremost experts in the languages. They compared what they had in the scrolls with anything else, the oldest extant documents. There were, especially with the scrolls, with obviously there were lots of tears and missing bits and nibbled bits and bits put in the wrong place. So it all seemed a bit haphazard, but through language analysis and also paleography, the art of studying the sort of handwriting that was used, they were able to put together what was consistent with what else. There were quite a lot of guesswork and reconstruction, in the sense that where there were large patches missing out of the scrolls, the scholars would suggest what probably went there, words that would fit with the, you know, that would link into the rest of the reference language, so as I was saying. But where it's reconstruction, they always put it in square brackets. You know, there are often various possible interpretations for people coming after them.
Okay. I think it was late in the 1950s when things get a little bit more interesting. Your father did a series of interviews with the BBC. Could you talk a little bit about that time?
Right. Well, it was a series of three talks in January 1956, just at the point and the copper scroll was being opened. There were popular talks. They only went out on the Northern Home Service of the BBC, so it was a very limited audience. They were saying what the scrolls were, how they'd been found, and what they were about, and who had written them, and so on, John thought he was doing no more than he'd been already doing for months, giving popular lectures to people and talking about the discussion of the scrolls.
Mm-hmm.
And the team didn't see it quite like that, because in the talk, he went on to draw the what he thought were obvious inescapable parallels between what the scrolls depicted of the sect, the Essenes, and the gospel stories. He said why there were such a strong and inescapable links between them, but he also went on to make an imaginative reconstruction of what, from various references he found to things like crucifixion and the end of days and the importance of the sectarian leader, the teacher of righteousness. He posited that the teacher was very likely to have had a similar sort of fate to Jesus, in that he felt he'd been crucified, and having been crucified would have been put in a tomb and carefully watched. And to his utter astonishment, this caused a great uproar back in Jerusalem. It was partly because the talks were reported and distorted to some extent, as they happened with the New York Times, and reports got back second-hand to Jerusalem, and pretty seemed to think it's a lot more astonishing than it was, at least that John thought it was. But everything changed very suddenly for John. They immediately felt he'd gone far too far in putting out theories about the teacher of righteousness without consulting them. Now, he did have a point, I must say, though he hadn't meant it to be really serious, but that's what they didn't thought. And they suddenly felt he was out of control. They couldn't trust him to say anything or not say anything. They assumed he'd been talking to people about the copper scroll, as he'd promised not to. In fact, he hadn't. There's various embellishments put in by the New York Times, I think, led him to say that. And everything turned to poison very suddenly. Nothing he said was welcomed or believed or trusted. By then he was in the middle of sorting out the second roll of copper, but he suddenly felt he wasn't even allowed to go into the laboratory or talk to Wright Baker about what he was finding.
Hmm.
And as you say, it simply turned to poison. He couldn't understand what was going on. But it very effectively put a distance between John and the rest of the team, and very nearly put an end to his career.
Okay, wow. Was it an organized effort, do you think? I mean, do you think there was an agenda at work, or do you think it was just a fluke that all that stuff happened?
I think that the rest of the team panicked, really. Nothing seems to have been terribly organized, but except that once they decided that they lost control of John, they wrote to his professor in Manchester, they wrote to Wright Baker, and effectively turned everybody against him.
Huh.
And in that sense, it was organized. But,
could you maybe explain a little bit further what the big concern was? In other words, the stories that seemed to be relayed in the copper scroll, or in the scrolls in general, seemed to point towards stories and teachings that were that seemed similar in nature to that of the Christian tradition, they preceded it. Is this the deal?
It wasn't actually the copper scroll; that was completely different. But yes, the thing was that these Essene scrolls, assuming they were Essene, they contained phrases, words, stories, things that were so obviously the same as much of the language and the stories in the parables and things within the New Testament, that John thought the link between them must be inescapable.
Mm-hmm.
He believed that the Essene beliefs must have been taken up by the early Christians. He thought it quite likely, though there was no particular proof, that Jesus and John the Baptist had come across Essene teachings or had been schooled there. He thought that because he found various references to the crucifixion scattered among his section of the text that he'd been working on, and also he thought they were backed up by various references to the sepulchre of the hanged man in the copper scroll. He thought there had been a particularly significant crucifixion that had concerned the Essenes. He had also found a historical reference, one of very few, I must say, in this part of the scrolls, that linked it with a leader, Alexander Yemaeus, who was known to have been acted as rather cruel tyrants and crucified at one point. 800 was on go of his opponents. He linked them all together, and though he stressed it was only a theory, he thought it extremely likely that crucifixion, which had been so crucial that the Essenes had actually written about it in their scrolls, whereas they referred to very few other historical events. He thought it must have been significant enough for them for it to have happened to somebody like their teacher. So he constructed the theory that the teacher might well have been crucified and his body is thereafter treated with care, as one would expect for the leader of your community.
Mm-hmm.
Because this was so similar to what had happened to Jesus, the others thought that he was jumping to conclusions that Jesus was no longer the unique God-given saviour whose story, as told in the New Testament, was gospel-based, obviously.
Right. Well, it turns out that there are many references to similar stories in history.
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
Yeah. Anyway, okay, well, in some of the scrolls, there is talk of treasure, gold, silver, this sort of thing.
This is the copper scroll, yes.
Right, in the copper scroll. Eventually, after your father either gets fed up or just sort of backs away from the controversy, he goes back to the Middle East and goes treasure hunting for quite some time and continues his research. Maybe you can talk about those in-between years a little bit, between maybe 1960 and the time when he finally releases the sacred mushroom and the cross.
Right. So, talk about the copper scroll more. The major fission between him and the team over this scroll was that he believed that the way he translated it, it was a list of treasure. He believed this was absolutely real. He thought that the way that it was written down, the copper scroll being made of copper, which is really precious material, but besides being precious, could be purified, meant that it was valuable. He couldn't think why people would go to the trouble of writing a list of fictitious measurements and objects down on valuable copper material if it weren't real.
Mm-hmm.
He felt that the places referred to, the hiding places for all this treasure, could be related to various places that he already was aware of around Qumran in particular, which was in fact backed up by various finds of things like juglets of silver coins in the ruins at Qumran. The rest of the team made out that it couldn't possibly be real treasure, that it was part of the genre of Arabic literature about treasure troves and, well, magic and fantasy and all the rest.
Mm-hmm.
They held that the quantities of treasure described were impossible. They couldn't possibly have been real in any way.
So they were talking about a real large bounty here.
Yeah, or 60 talents, thousands of tons. But as John pointed out, the measurements in those days weren't necessarily the same dimensions that they held in the 1950s and 60s. You know, quite likely they'd changed anyway. He didn't take too seriously that it could possibly be fiction. He couldn't understand why they gave this out as the official release, that the scroll was just part of a fairy tale genre of Arabic literature, when he was so convinced that it was real. He did suspect that there was such a delay between the discovery of the scroll, the opening of the scroll, and then several months later, the press release to this effect, but it was there wasn't real anyway. He suspected they were deliberately not much falsifying it, but ignoring what he felt was the truth, or even debate about it. This could have been for several reasons, the most important of which was to avoid having the whole of the Jordanian desert turned upside down by treasure seekers, which was a strong point that he did in fact to agree with. But on the other hand, he also felt that it could have something to do with his own unpopularity by then, that they were trying to distance him from any further official announcements about the treasure.
Okay.
So be that as it may, anyway, though, it's just served to establish the rift between them even more. Anyway, he didn't give up believing that the treasure was real, and he set about organizing expeditions to try and, if not find the treasure, at least to establish the places, the topography of the place, which to some extent he did. Unfortunately, he didn't find any treasure. He went back for 4 or 5, maybe even 6 expeditions, and I did quite a lot of excavating of various caves and found evidence of settlement and lots of interesting artifacts, but none of the treasure of the Copper Scroll, unfortunately. However, I think his belief has been vindicated, as I saw the majority of scholars nowadays do accept his arguments and his translations, that it was treasure, it was real. It probably belonged to the Jerusalem temple and most likely had been hidden away in these caves at the time the temple was sacked by the Romans in AD 70. Definitive proof never actually been found, but that's definitely the balance of opinion now.
He
would just go over to Jordan for a few weeks most winters. So most of the time he was based in Manchester. He didn't cease to be a lecturer at the university. But this was in his spare time, and he'd organize groups, mostly amateur, a few professional archaeologists, cameramen, architects who were good at drawing and so on. It was a great time doing the expeditions anyway.
And they came across, I'm sure they came across other things during this time and all these expeditions.
Well, in some of the caves they were exploring, they certainly found evidence of occupation, like coins and clothing and cooking pots, that sort of thing. So the caves had obviously been used for living in. It's not very clear when and why, because the remains went back to Chalcolithic times, 6000 BC, I think, right up to the 2nd century AD, probably connected with later revolts of the Jewish people against the Romans. The finds were very scattered, I must say. You know, it wasn't as conclusive as they'd like it to. And they went on organizing them up through early 1960s, but then the political situation was getting so very difficult between Israel and Jordan that it wasn't safe to go on very much longer with the practical work of excavations. It all got taken over, really.
Okay. All right. In 1970, then, we get the release of this amazing book called The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. Maybe you could mention about a couple things. First of all, what was your dad's intention with the release of this book? And I'd also like you to talk about what it meant to him. I know it was basically the culmination of the work that he'd been doing for 20 years at least.
It was, yes. What he was trying to do is to relate the development of language on our continent to the development of myths, religions, and cultic practices in many cultures. Now, he did it through exploring the Sumerian language, the earliest known language within on this continent anyway, from its beginnings in cuneiform through inscriptions, various tablets. He was able to relate it to Akkadian and eventually Phoenician, Semitic, Indo-European languages. He was basically a philologist, so his job, his expertise was language development. And through taking the bits and pieces of Sumerian that had by then been found, not really as much as has since been found, I believe, we were taking them to pieces and seeing how elements of Sumerian persisted in the various developments of the languages, and all the languages it influenced around its neighbours and eventually spreading throughout Europe. He believed he could show how not only volumes, the original word creeks of the language, but also some of the meanings they carried with them persisted and influenced other cultures and religions. A large part of the early words and things were written down, worth writing down, which seems automatic to us, the idea of writing things down, but right at the beginning of things, it was new. It was the sense of invention, really, writing it down. They would only write down the what was most important to them. Much of it concerned religion, fertility cults, the practices of the kings and the priests who administered the religion. Part of that, being fertility cults, was about obviously sex, phallic symbols, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And because they seemed to use various means to get them, the priests would use various means to get themselves into a trance where they could speak to their God, commune with the divine light, however they saw it. They used things like dancing and meditation, fasting, and the most efficacious of all was drugs, these hallucinogenic drugs such as those found in the sacred mushroom, Amanita muscaria, and related ones. Needless to say, it was the idea of linking mushrooms with religions, and in particular with Christian religion, that caused the scandal. The process of simplification, John was thought to be talking about the way that all religions, up to and including Christianity, were based on these original cultic practices, which in turn were based on the use of the mushroom as a hallucinogen, which enabled the shamans, the kings, the priests, to commune with God and bring the divine will to control divine will, what they wanted to do.
You know, the idea of the fertility cult as well seems to be one that might get under their skin as well, because this is a representation of the feminine that has been so deeply repressed for so long. Is that a part of this as well?
Yeah, it was a great cause of shock. In fact, it wasn't all that new. Again, he was just bringing together work that had been done by lots of other people. Many scholars had been looking into other religions, particularly the classical ones, Greek and Roman mythology, mm-hmm. Indian ones, the Vedic culture, various Celtic religions, and had already established the importance of hallucinogens for culture as part of religious experience. Nobody had explicitly related it to Christianity as well. John maintained that such practices were quite likely to be still going on in Christian times. One aspect of his work that caused a great deal of controversy with reason was that he assumed that because he could find traces of Sumerian words for this cult, other cults and so on, within the language of the ancient Hebrews, the Aramaicisms, particularly many of the names and incantations he found throughout the Gospels, he assumed that this meant that the incantations, the drug use, was still going on then. But through a process of deception was being kept underground. It sounds even more unlikely when I'm trying to explain it than it does he was writing it. But part of his thesis was that because it's all secret knowledge, esoteric knowledge known only to a few, they would try to disguise it from the Romans, the authorities, in order to continue to practice their secret cults. And he thought that because he'd found clues within the language, it could be mistranslated or interpreted or spun into stories that he felt might be a deliberate method, a deliberate way to deceive the people in general.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
He found basic religious ideas passing on from Sumerian times through the genealogy of words, the way the languages had developed. It took him back to the development of language and religion together, intertwined. It took him back to the myths, religions, and cultic practices of the Sumerians, which then became myths, religions, and cultic practices, or aspects of these stories and practices and rituals and things like that,
mm-hmm.
in other religions subsequent to the Sumerian ones.
Well, I find it fascinating because, well, for lots and lots of reasons, but, you know, I think about the fact that at the same time as your father was just getting involved in things in Jordan in the 1950s, On the other side of the world, in Mexico, Gordon Wasson and his wife, Valentina, are being introduced to the sacred mushroom mysteries of the Mazatec people and Maria Sabina, this amazing woman shaman, literally at the same time in 1952 and 1953. It's a remarkable.
Indeed, and Wasson also related the soma of Indian Vedic culture to Amanita Muscari.
Yes,
identified the two.
Yes.
And there was also Robert Graves, the poet, mm-hmm. who was sure that Dionysiac revels and the and other Greek practices, Greek and Roman practices, were based on the same sort of ritual involving mushrooms. So there was lots of work going on at the same time. It was just relating it to Christianity that got my father into trouble.
Right. Why a mushroom? Let's talk about the symbology and the significance of the mushroom. Not necessarily its chemical construction, but it's also physical construction.
Well, there was the look of it. An extremely stylized mushroom could also be taken as an extremely stylized cross shape, more particularly in the way it developed from a little egg-like ball, which then grew upwards with obvious phallic significance through a red-tipped shaft mm-hmm. and spread out at the top. It could be taken to be a representation of coitus as well as a cross. It could be taken to be a representation of an awful lot, really. It's a simple sort of design that could or could not be used as a symbol for various purposes. I'm not quite sure how far you can really take it mm-hmm. The way that John suggested it, except that the mushroom itself does recur in art and architecture throughout the Middle Ages even, as well as designs from the Dark Ages, except that in Byzantine and Indian Eastern countries, it wasn't the Dark Age. The symbols do recur, and they crop up in even in church architecture and stained glass windows, things like that. So there is evidence that it has been used much more widely than is generally accepted. My father never actually went into it nearly as much as he could have done, I think. I think if he had brought out the various appearances of mushroom, it's obvious use in pagan religions, witchcraft, things like that, he probably have found his theories much more widely accepted.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He concentrated on the language development. And this was so difficult, rare abstruse esoteric knowledge. He was treating these words for the mushroom names throughout various languages, which are mostly completely dead and very little studied.
Mm-hmm.
The way he did it was rather speculative as well, and he found enormous difficulty in getting this taken seriously.
Right.
So, as you said at the beginning, he'd been spending 20 years of language study culminating in this. So it certainly wasn't the hoax that he was accused of inventing.
Okay. Well, I was going to say that, you know, I was going to ask, I should say, that how the book was reacted to, how it was received. I think people can maybe extrapolate that it wasn't received very well. But I think that the point to be made is still one that needs to be looked at, because I know that it was a very serious effort on your father's part, and he really did believe that in the mushroom as sort of this grand unifying theory.
Yes, he did. He felt that it underlay so much of language and religion that it was like a grand universal theory of religion, something that nearly all the ones he looked at could trace their roots down to. However, it was proving it that was difficult for people to follow. It was enormously important to him. He felt it was the culmination of all his work. He knew it was going to be very controversial. He wasn't really expecting quite such hostility from virtually everybody. It ruined his career.
What came afterwards? I know he wrote a book called The End of a Road.
Mm-hmm. He decided to leave the university and to be a full-time writer. He wanted to set out completely on his own. The End of the Road was looking at the philosophical and moral questions that would face people once they'd given up their dependence on religion. By then, he was feeling that it was him versus the church, really, largely because of the reaction of virtually everybody, both the academic and ecclesiastical establishment. He took a very humanitarian humanist line, really. He eschewed even that. He liked to be an individual. He believed in freedom of thought, and he wouldn't actually label himself even a humanist. That's less what it came to. He felt that without religion, man had to stand on his own feet, make up his own mind about things, work out his own moral standing in relationship to other people. And The End of the Road was pointing out the questions that people had to think out for themselves, which he felt was the most responsible and truthful way of approaching life.
Right.
In other words, one without the prop or the guidance of religion.
Okay.
We followed that by Chosen People, which was a history of the Jewish people in the Old Testament times, up to about the 2nd century BC. And after that, he branched out rather. He looked at anthropology, and he wrote about various lost religions. And another one is Physician Heal Thyself. He was looking at the knowledge of the Essenes, and kept going back to the Essenes of the scrolls and their medical and astrological spiritual knowledge, where it came from, relating to other references in the Old Testament and the cultural texts, exploring aspects of the healing process.
Judith, were the Dead Sea Scrolls ever published?
The scrolls themselves?
Yes.
Not until 1991. He spent his whole life campaigning for them to be published and made accessible to the people so people could ask their own questions about it, their significance. But he died in 1988, and right at the end he was railing against the establishment for not releasing them before then. So it was other scholars who equally stood to stand against establishment figures who actually got it released.
Remarkable. Did your father have any protégés or younger researchers that picked up on his work and that grabbed the thread?
Well, as far as I know, nobody's really followed up on the Sumerian links, and people have studied Sumerian. They know a lot more about it now. They've found a lot more tablets, inscriptions, and everything else. But I think it's still worth waiting to be done to explore how far the ideas that the Sumerians expressed in their language have affected other languages and cults and ideas throughout the ages.
Right.
Other people have looked again at his work on the scrolls and carried on with his translation work, which needed to be done. I mean, he only got so far, really. And subsequent scholars have taken it further. And they've looked at the copper scroll again, certainly.
Okay. Well, I've got one more question for you, and it's sort of a personal one. I guess with such a remarkable man as a father, I have to ask you how influential your father was and his work on the unfolding of your own life.
Well, I'm no scholar of Arabic, Hebrew, Sumerian, or anything else. I haven't followed him in that. And in fact, he didn't really talk about it much to us at all until in the last few years of his life. I used to go and discuss it with him because we didn't live so far away from him then.
Uh-huh.
That was fascinating. The idea that he was getting back to the very beginnings of language, of the religion, and all the ideas that come from that was amazing. You know, the most important questions of all, really, how people began to think.
Right.
But that was certainly thinking a lot. Otherwise, it's mainly passed on to my brother and me, just a sort of questioning attitude. I believe that you have to ask your own questions, make up your own mind about things. He was a free thinker. He certainly believed in original ideas and in not taking anything for granted. That's been important.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I want to thank you so much for, first of all, for the effort in writing the book, John Marco Allegro, The Maverick of the Dead Sea Scrolls, because you were really able to, with a great deal of class, write a book that sort of leveled the playing field about your father and the work that he had done, and I'm greatly appreciative of it, and I hope that many more people read that book and read your father's work as well.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to personally thank Jan Irvin, who put Judy and I in touch with one another. And Judith, thank you so much for spending some time with us this morning, because it's wonderful and relevant material, and very few people, at least in my generation, are aware of this stuff. So once again, thank you from the bottom of my heart for doing the work and for continuing to share the information with other people.
Thank you for your interest.
All right, everybody. Hi, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And there you have it, a wonderful hour and 15 minutes or so with Judith Ann Brown, the daughter of John Marco Allegro. I hope you appreciated that. And somebody mentioned online, I wish there was a transcript of this interview. And I'm going to make that a priority to get that done, because I know that the audio wasn't the best that I've ever had done on a recorded interview, and there's an accent to deal with as well. Actually, there's always accents to deal with, you know. If they're listening to this program overseas, they have to deal with my accent, you know, if they heard this in England right now. So anyway, we all have our own ways to talk, and anyway, great stuff there from Judy, and I hope you appreciate it, and we'll try to get that in text version as well, in some sort of a transcript sometime in the reasonably near future, okay? All right, it's about 7 minutes after the hour of 1 o'clock, now on the 20th of February, 2007, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Let's listen to another piece of music here from my friends over there at ITOM Lab. We'll come back, and I've got a couple things in the news and a little rant and raving that I've need to get off my chest, and I'll do that when we come back, okay? In the meantime, like I said, ITOM Lab, this one is called Walk In on the Equation, and great new music that I'm glad we have a chance to share with you tonight, and we got a couple more for you before the end of the program, okay? Stick around, it's Mike, back in a few minutes.
This emerging paradigm of the spirit. You can see the distortion it was creating just by sitting there. It's just like, wow. Tumbling forward into these fractal geometric spaces made of light. I'm a battery in hallucinogens. I just happened to walk in on the equation. I discovered I have, I guess it's that couldn't be stopped.
which we perceive is a tiny fraction of the world which we can perceive, which is a tiny fraction of the perceivable world.
Walk in on the equation. ITOM Lab. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Oh, I don't know, maybe quarter after. Not quite, but about quarter after one now in the morning on the 20th of February, 2007. And hello to everybody out there. Listen, been a fun show. Did a little recorded interview that we don't typically do, usually live stuff on the program these days, but something that needed to be heard for sure. Judith Ann Brown, the daughter of John Marco Allegro. And if you're just tuning in and you wonder who that is, I'll tell you real quickly just so you can go to the archives and listen to the whole show. But John Marco Allegro was one of the original four team members who was assigned the task or granted the privilege or doomed to hell, depending on how you look at it, to decipher and translate and further excavate the Dead Sea Scrolls. And amazing stuff that John Marco Allegro discovered on his own and that his daughter is sharing with everyone as well. So thanks to Judy for a great bit of time, and also to John, who actually was born and died on February 17th, born on the 23rd, 1923, actually, and died in 1988. And so, certainly the show dedicated to John Marco Allegro, all right? All right, let's see. What else? Tickets. I have a couple tickets to give away to the show on Friday at the Blue Fugue. John Henry and the Engine, The Feed, and Hazard to Your Booty. So, next time we take a break here, and I don't know, 15 or 20, whatever, I'll remind you again, but if I don't remind you, somebody call at 573-874-5676, and I'll give you a couple tickets or get you on the guest list or whatever for that show. Okay? All right, let's see. In the news, well, this is something that I've wanted to talk about, actually, and there's a good reason to talk about it because it's in the news. And I'll just start right off with the story here. Industrial Hemp Farming Act of 2007... introduced in Congress. This is a story from February 14th, so a week or so ago, and I'll just read a snip from it here and then I'll riff a little bit on it. For the second time since the federal government outlawed hemp farming in the United States, a federal bill has been introduced that would remove restrictions on the cultivation of non-psychoactive industrial hemp. The chief sponsor of H.R. 1009, the Industrial Hemp Farming Act of 2007, is Representative Ron Paul, who, by the way, is also a candidate for president in the upcoming election in 2008. And there are a number of other co-sponsors to the bill. All right, here's a quote from Dr. Paul. "It is indefensible that the United States government prevents American farmers from growing this crop. The prohibition subsidizes farmers in countries from Canada to Romania by eliminating American competition and encourages jobs in industries such as food, auto parts, and clothing that utilize industrial hemp to be located overseas instead of in the United States," said Dr. Paul. "By passing the Industrial Hemp Farming Act, the House of Representatives can help American farmers reduce the trade deficit and do it all without spending a single taxpayer dollar." Now, of course, the article goes on to a greater extent than that, and if you're interested in this, you can go just do a search on the Industrial Hemp Farming Act of 2007, and you can learn a little bit about it. And in the meantime, you should learn a little bit about the history of this particular plant And I'm going to talk a little bit about it right now, I guess, because I've had a lot of questions that have come in email lately, both locally and also from listeners who are listening outside of the state, but a lot of stuff locally lately because people are tuning into this. So anyway, there have been a lot of questions about hemp, about marijuana, and about psychedelics. So let me relate something to begin this whole thing, all right? Let me relate something to you that has sort of gotten me upset. I've maintained for a long time that anyone unwilling to discuss hemp as an agricultural gold mine and an environmental godsend is a person who can be pretty much shown as ignorant or disingenuous. So here's a little bit of a story for y'all, all right? And this is especially for the progressive-minded people here in mid-Missouri, okay? There is all this talk of sustainability, and it prompted me to address the hemp issue with both of our local newspapers. And I'm going to read to you the letter that I sent to both the Columbia Tribune and to the Missourian over 3 weeks ago, as a matter of fact, all right? And here's the letter, okay? It goes just like this. There is much talk these days in Columbia and the mid-Missouri region about sustainability and how we might all work together toward a more reasonable, healthy, and green future. I've attended a number of the meetings and talked to a whole lot of people, and so far I've not heard anyone mention the benefits of the reintroduction of industrial hemp into the local and regional economy. I see zero reasons why this simple step could not have an immediate and positive impact on the local, regional, and state economies, as well as all of the concerns of sustainability and environmentally minded people. Anyone not willing to discuss the reintroduction of industrial hemp into the Missouri economy is not truly serious about these concerns. How are we to take seriously those who ignore and reject a single most beneficial solution to a whole host of environmental and energy issues? Food, fuel, textiles, animal fodder, soil rejuvenation, all from one plant that can be grown anywhere in this state without pesticides and without fertilizers, hemp. If people were serious about the severity of the crisis we are facing, only psychosis could explain such an obvious ignorance of solution. Rejecting the realities of the hemp plant is no longer an excuse. This is a big-time corrective measure that can be implemented essentially overnight, and it is something that everyone who is sincere about sustainable community and a green future should be able to agree upon. How about it? Is this community progressive enough to consider the wisdom of the world's oldest cultivated plant and one that could really truly help us? And if not, for God's sake, why? All right? So that's the end of my letter, signed, of course, me, Mike Hagan. And it went out to both newspapers here, the Columbia Tribune and the Columbia Missourian. And guess what? Now, this is before the Hemp Act news came out, although maybe I was privy to information before, and regardless, this is 3 or 4 weeks ago I sent this letter. And guess what? Nothing. No response. It wasn't published, and in fact, I didn't even get the courtesy of a reply from anyone at either of the papers. Not even an FU reply, you know, the auto reply, the thing that you come, that, you know, that the machine sends back to you, you know. And I don't dig being ignored like anybody. So I guess I want to put a question out there to all the journalists in town. And the question is this. Are you willing to research, investigate, and report on the hemp story in a credible, unbiased, and courageous fashion? That's my question. I mean, come on. Where's the hardcore journalism in this town? Where's all the forward-thinking, creative, inquisitive journalism professionals on this subject? Where's the deep digging, the investigative reporting here at Mizzou on sustainability, Gaian theory, viable fuel alternatives, these sorts of things? Very little of it. Something other than what's being pushed by the usual suspects and their lobbies. We have a celebrated journalism school here in Mizzou, right? I challenge all of you to investigate the hemp story, the entire story, you know, the history of it, everything, and start to report on it honestly. We need journalists that will begin to do investigative reporting again and not do news by press release.
we have enough news by press release. It's called oil-soaked lapdog journalism. And it's not the young people's fault who are going into these fields. They're essentially innocent and believe what's being taught to them. I wonder how much the average journalism student knows about the history of newspapers. Do they know who William Randolph Hearst was? Do they teach about him at the vaunted Mizzou School of Journalism? Let me tell you a little bit about William Randolph Hearst if they don't teach you about him. He was essentially a newspaper tycoon who was also in the pulp business. So essentially, he made a boatload of cash cutting down trees, turning them into paper, and then printing his own propaganda on the paper and selling it to the public as news. Sound familiar? But anyway, he's a scumbag, all right? And I'm not the only one that recognizes this. You know, there was a book, I don't know, 15 years ago, plus or minus. It was called Unreliable Sources. It was written by a guy named Martin Lee with a partner. I forget his partner's name. But anyway, Martin Lee wrote a book called Unreliable Sources, and he talked about how William Randolph Hearst routinely invented sensational stories and faked interviews and ran phony pictures and distorted real events and was one of the pioneers in the use of what eventually became known as yellow journalism. He ran this one paper called the New York Journal, and he would use these techniques to whip up popular support for things like U.S. military adventurism in Cuba, in the Philippines, in Puerto Rico. This is in the late 1800s and the early 1900s. There's another great author named Upton Sinclair who wrote a book called The Brass Check. Here's another one for all you journalism students. The Brass Check. It's called A Study of American Journalism. And Upton Sinclair talked about William Hearst again and about how he and his employees were willing to do anything, essentially, to make up shameful lies made up of whole cloth to stir nations to enmity and drive them to war. Of course, the same strategy was used to spread propaganda relentlessly about the plant, the cannabis plant. He used his own papers to spread propaganda about this whole business. And we've been living it for 70 years. So William Randolph Hearst and the DuPont family, another familiar name, another American icon, along with a few other influential cohorts, were primarily responsible for this ramrodding through Congress of the Marijuana Tax Act, which was passed in 1937. The reasoning behind this bill that was virtually illegally put through Congress anyway, but that's not the first time that's happened. Look at the Federal Reserve Act. At any rate, the reason had nothing to do with moral or health-related issues, had nothing to do with anything like this. They were trying to prevent the growth of a new industry so that they wouldn't go bankrupt, so that they wouldn't go broke. It was essentially a turf war and a profit issue. And hemp threatened William Randolph Hearst's pulp business. And to this day, hemp is included in the same witch hunt for its detrimental effects, not on human biology, but for its detrimental effects on the gigantic profits of every wood pulp and petrochemical-based industry on this planet. And we basically have William Randolph Hearst and his greedy sociopath freak contemporaries to thank for that. This is the same bunch, by the way, who promoted the slang term marijuana, with the idea being to equate cannabis, which was the term that had been familiar and goes back eons and can be traced back into every religion on this planet that these people are touting. But the idea was to equate cannabis with, you know, those unclean, brown-skinned, subhuman folks south of the border and covertly influence mainstream white-bread America
to take a very dim view of this substance and the plant. And 70-odd years later, you know, it looks like the tactic worked pretty well. But, you know, nothing lasts forever. And the cat's out of the sack, okay? So with that in mind, I would implore all of you to, first of all, consciously use the word cannabis instead of the word marijuana when conversing on the subject. You know, it's no wonder I can't get a letter published about this stuff in the papers. Most of the papers, and by association their staffs, they still carry this twisted tradition that they don't even know they're a part of. And in that tradition, there are certain things that are taboo. The hemp cannabis story is one of those taboos. 100 years ago, this was a huge and growing part of a sustainable economy. Today, it is maligned, misunderstood. It is the target of a ruthless propaganda campaign that has gone on for decades and is constantly under genocidal attack. As a species, you see? As a species. What gives anyone the right to determine which species are allowed to continue and which are not? Genocide is genocide. Animal or plant. Or idea. It's just remarkable. How progressive of us. Anyway, I'm looking at my email here, and I have a question here. And again, the question regards, the reason I'm reading it is because it's obviously the guy's listening or whatever, or the girl. And it says, regarding hemp, marijuana, and psychedelics, is it purely a financial issue in which the powers that be want to keep a handle on the dollars generated by the products, or is it also an ideological, philosophical repression? Well, whoever asked this is a smart person, first of all, because they recognized that Hearst and his ilk, they could have jumped on the bandwagon. They could have jumped on the hemp bandwagon and made just as much money on hemp as they were making chopping down trees or cotton or whatever. So why did they opt for criminalization? It's interesting because nowhere is the contradiction in economic logic more clear than in this case of cannabis and hemp. And I'll get back to that in just a second, but let me riff on something else first since they bring it up. You know, it sort of simplifies the issue to say that it's entirely a money thing because psychedelics are used by such a small percentage of the population that they don't rate with the tremendous institutional rage and fury that they evoke from, you know, the powers that be. In other words, there isn't a whole lot of money being made by anyone in the psychedelic community. There never has been. So why is there such an unbalanced and vicious response to these particular substances? You see, the subtext behind the government and institutionalized fear of psychedelics, I think, is that this quality of the visionary plants, and you know me, I only talk about the plants. I'm not into the synthetics. Let other people talk about that. But this quality of the visionary plants to dissolve boundaries causes people to question basic assumptions about how society works and how it is run. The experiences that people have when they do these things are so powerful and so profound that it causes them to make a reassessment of their worldview. Simply because the lens that they are viewing the world through just opened way up. So this is threatening to the ruling power structure. And I think this is true of any society. I mean, it isn't just an American phenomenon. Because it doesn't matter if you're a red Chinese Marxist or a libertarian quality control technician from Hicktown, Missouri. When you ingest one of these substances, psilocybin, for example, in the right set, in the right setting, whatever you are, you know, quantum physicist, Catholic priest, indigenous tribesman, you will question your first premises. You will question your primary beliefs. And when you get millions of people questioning their first premises, questioning their primary beliefs, governments and other institutions with agendas of power and control, they get very nervous. I find it really interesting that, and ironic actually, that the whole phenomenon of the 1960s occurred because of the American commitment to universal public education. And that commitment was just bringing its first generation of children to adulthood in the 60s. Because that universal commitment to education began just after World War II. And after the people at top levels of establishment actually got a look at what this meant, the building and funding of great public universities and filling them with inquisitive and creative young minds, when they saw what the result of that was, well, that's when they decided to turn the universities back into trade schools for certified public accountants and the coveteers of MBAs and this sort of people, you know, which they did in fact do. I mean, there is nothing of the sort of thing that was being encouraged of students back in the 1960s and the early 70s. Nothing of the sort of education and intellectual curiosity that was going on back then. None of that is still in place. That's all finished now. Now what we expect of college graduates is, you know, you're expected to do your data entry job without reproach or question. You're expected to watch a boatload of television, which is a powerful drug in and of itself. And you're expected to keep your mouth shut. That's basically what we expect of college grads these days. See, essentially, there was a crisis of faith in American institutions back in the 1960s, and this was only made, it was intensified by psychedelics. In other words, it was a combination of educating people in large numbers for the first time, you know, not indoctrinating people or conditioning people, but it was actually a combination of educating people in large numbers for the first time to the actual traditions and history of Western civilization, and then giving them access to psychedelics. And people began to ask questions for which there were no answers. And the response of the establishment was and is suppression and repression, a most brutal repression, as a matter of fact. Just look at who's in jail and how many of them. Now, the question of cannabis is what got me started on this thread. And many of you are familiar, thanks to the work of those in the hemp community for many years, that cannabis presents many positive benefits, not necessarily related to its properties as an intoxicant, but as a source of food, fuel, lubricants, plastics, clothing, paper. And the real reason that the powers that be are so hysterical on the subject of cannabis is because its use erodes loyalty to the values of the industrial state. It erodes faith in the ideas, the ideals, and the pillars of consumer capitalism. I mean, that's why. I mean, come on. Let's look at the pharmacology of a couple of familiar drugs to make the comparison, all right? Let's look, number one, at caffeine. We all know what that one is, right? Well, we have the medical data, too. And we know that it can cause fetal malformation. We know it damages the liver. We know it damages the kidneys, the stomach. We know these things. Now, cannabis, number two in our comparison here, and by the way, vast amounts of money have been spent trying to find something wrong with this stuff, and they're still digging, folks. I mean, they've determined that, you know, it doesn't cause tits to grow on statues and all the other ridiculous stuff that they've tried to push about this plant. All of that stuff has had to be abandoned. And now the only way those arguments stand is next to ignorance. Anyone who does their homework knows what's really going on now. So why is caffeine enshrined then into the contracts of every labor negotiation in the Western world as a sacred right of all workers to dose up twice a day. Why is that? And why then with cannabis can you lose your job, your home, your car, your music collection, your children, simply because you had a few plants growing in the back 40? Why the disparity? I'll tell you why. Let's look at what these two drugs do. What is the effect of caffeine? Well, with regard to labor contracts, it allows a worker to perform as productively during the last few hours of work as he does during the first few hours of work. It allows people to tolerate spinning out worthless widgets until hell freezes over without ever having the thought enter their mind that this might be a ridiculous way to spend their life. Cannabis, now, on the other hand, sure, people aren't very interested in going to work. They don't want to go make widgets. There's a difference, my friends, between that and laziness, okay? But they're not interested in making widgets, perhaps. They'd rather stay home and make love or make art. And they don't want to watch brain-dead television. They'd rather twist a bomber and have a conversation with a friend. In other words, these things promote activities that, number one, don't make anyone any money, and number two, cause people to question the institutions and the social philosophies that are being jammed down their throats. On a level playing field, I think, caffeine might well be a prescription drug. Maybe that's not even a good idea, but it might well be. And cannabis might be freely available. The most dangerous drugs in our culture, in terms of their detrimental social effects, are alcohol and tobacco. The two most freely available, peddled on every street corner, every city. And I'd add television to the list. But, the argument I made with regard to caffeine can easily be modified to apply to these other socially condoned drugs, alcohol, tobacco, sugar. So we have this cracked brain approach to substances and the problem of drugs. Even though we're not the only society, all societies seem to do this. I mean, out of a possible spectrum of, I don't know, maybe 30 or so depressants and intoxicants, most cultures pick 3 or 4 that they hail as harmless and put up on a pedestal. And the rest of them, the spawn of Lucifer. And then this attitude is persevered with and propped up against all scientific evidence, against all medical research. It's just what people choose to believe. The problem is that we don't have the luxury anymore to keep up with this type of ignorance. We no longer can afford to embrace, culture-bound, provincial, and hick-like attitude that ignores solutions because of propaganda and boneheaded politics. The amount of revenue that could be provided by a cannabis economy, the pressure that could be taken off of petroleum use, petroleum extraction, so many other things, and they're all out there. All of these things can be improved greatly if cannabis were a part of the picture. All of these things make it incumbent upon us, make it our responsibility to think more creatively and more honestly about which drugs are really posing problems for us in this culture and this society. I've said it before, the situation we find ourselves in, the cultural crisis that we are fast approaching, if not in the middle of, is not a situation in which we need to find the answers. It is a situation in which we need to face the answers. So how about a starting point? All right? We've got a bill introduced in Congress by a Republican, all right, that gives you, all of you, Democrats, Republicans, Christians, Jews, I don't care what you are, it gives you the opportunity to embrace this thing without feeling silly, all right? And there's no reason to feel silly about it. Your ancestors, had a great symbiotic relationship with this plant. We've just been fed, a huge pottage. You know, we've been fed a line, and it's time to change things. So to get the ball rolling, and it's a good idea that is not my own, it starts like this. It starts by recognizing as legitimate that which we have denied for so long. Let us declare nature as legitimate. Let us declare all plants and all animals, for that matter, as legitimate and legal. The notion of an illegal plant or an illegal animal is obnoxious and preposterous as you being illegal or illegitimate. Nature does not create illegitimacy. So let's start there. All plants and all animals, legal and legitimate. And please, let's start to talk about this more in our community. It's time. It's time. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia.
When you go out into the universe, you just go bigger and bigger and bigger, and you keep looking for the edge, but you never find it. And the same thing happens when you go inward. Science reports and concentrates on this part of the picture, but it's not the whole story. The plants are powerful allies. The idea of symbiosis, botanical, natural, psychedelics,
for us, and again, the dynamic is despite the fancy substance.
Serotonin is a drug. They're neurotransmitters. The mycelial networks on this planet are the biggest brains on it.
Pay attention. It's the mushroom. 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 They're neurotransmitters. The mushroom is a symbiote for us. Has been for millions of years, something that's trying to reawaken itself.
That's right. The plants are powerful allies. Take advantage if you dare. All right, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit. It's about 10 minutes until 2 on the 20th of February. Got a few minutes left here. And just want to say hi to everyone who's been listening over the web. Been peeking in the chat room, and great to see everyone, and love to participate with everyone during the show. We have this music that's being presented tonight. We had John Henry and the gang earlier tonight, but throughout the interview that I had with Judith Ann Brown, and then later in the program here, we're listening to the music of a band called iTom Lab. And you can find information about iTom Lab on the web at iTomLab, iTomLab.com, and also at myspace.com/iTomLab. And great, cool synthetic music, if you haven't noticed. And thanks so much for getting that music to me tonight that I could air it on the program. We got it in just under the wire, and I was able to air some of this new music and stuff that was sort of written specifically for the program tonight. So great work, and thanks so much to all the people involved with iTom Lab. All right, it's Mike, and it's Radio Orbit. Stick around. We got some good music coming up for you here at 2 o'clock with Cool Creations. And, well, I think I'll just talk a little bit more about the show next week. Then I'll head out of here in a couple minutes, but I'm very excited about it. As I mentioned earlier, if you weren't listening at the beginning of the program, Dr. John Sheliak next week. He's a PhD mathematician, a nuclear physicist, and a guy who has another one of these resumes that I won't waste my time on, but trust me, if you want to investigate his background, he's certainly, his resume is certainly complete, let's just put it that way. And John is a friend of the gang, you see, because John was one of the few mathematicians who was willing to go out on a limb and support the work of Terence McKenna years ago, decades ago now. But he really did do an amazing job and was able to this day to put together the mathematics that basically put the time wave on safe, comfortable mathematical ground, which is basically quicksand anyway, you know, and Terence recognized that. But, you know, if you got to compete in this culture, you have to do it through science and mathematics. And the time wave is able to stand up to those rigorous or not standards, right? And John Sheliak was a major influence and a major factor in why that happened. So a big thank you to John for the work that he did with Terence. And we're going to talk with him about it next week and about everything else that he's been up to, in the in-between. So I hope you all come back, join me, and we'll do it again next week. I've got some great music lined up as well. We've got some live music at the beginning of the program next week from a band that I ran into tonight. And I'm not going to say any more about them. I'm just going to leave you cliffhanging. I'm not even going to tell you their name, but trust me, man, they're a lot of fun. So we'll have them early in the program, then we'll have some other stuff during the show with John, and we'll come back and say hello, all right? It's Mike. You've been listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, and it's Radio Orbit. Thanks so much, everyone, for listening on the web, www.mikehagan.com. You can listen to this program and any other ones that we've done over the last 3 years. They're available for free and forever in the archives at mikehagan.com, and I implore you, listen to them, download them, share them with your friends, all right? And listen to the song. It's called Molecular, one last one from iTom Lab. It's Mike. You've been listening to Radio Orbit. I'll talk to you next week.
high enough dose, usually people feel that their consciousness leaves their body. And oftentimes as well, through the combination of the visual effects and the feeling of dissociation from the body, it seems for a lot of people that they enter into a different sort of realm of consciousness or of existence, or of consciousness or of existence. Consciousness or of existence. Consciousness or of existence.